This episode is brought to you by the Michigan Cherry Committee. Learn about the wonderfully tart Montmorency cherry at choosecherries.com.
Hello, and welcome to A Hungry Society. I'm Korsha Wilson, and this is a show where we talk about food, food media, and so much more. Today's show is an interview with chef, artist, model, and photographer Devon Francis. Devon runs a pop-up here in New York called Yardy, where he uses food, space, music, and art to explore Blackness, queerness, immigration, and more. He's a first-generation Jamaican-American, and his cooking is influenced by the Caribbean. I went to a Yardy event last year, and it was so good. The food was delicious, but also the music, the space, the love for Black culture and Caribbean culture. You could just feel it through everything in the space. As I've been at home and thinking about the people I want to talk to on this show, Devon was one of the first names that I thought of, and I'm so happy he made the time to talk to me. You're going to hear us talk about food as art, the idea of expansiveness and hospitality, and Devon even shouts out some of the writers, chefs, and thinkers that he's looking to for inspiration right now. I hope you like this episode, and I hope you and yours are safe right now. Okay, so we are here with Devon Francis of Yardy, and I'm so excited. You have been on my mind like as a guest for a long time. And I've had your food. It's so delicious. So I'm so happy that you're on A Hungry Society.
Yes. Oh my God. Thank you so much for having me. I am so grateful to be here. And all the guests that you've featured before, I'm fans of everyone. So this is such a great time to talk with you. And I'm so excited to do it.
So I have, like I said before, I've had your food. It's really delicious. And Yardy is such a fun, cool, like meaningful and like visually stunning exploration of, to me, it feels like an exploration of what it means to be both American and Caribbean American. I want to hear in your own words though, like how you describe Yardy to people who haven't been to an event before.
Yeah, absolutely. So Yardy is an event and production company where we pride ourselves in creating experiences for people to participate in and to collaborate on with us and our brand. As you were sort of mentioning, you know, my background is, you know, my parents are both from Jamaica, and a lot of the sort of cultural influences, be it flavor, food, music, fashion, all of those things kind of influence the way that the event comes together with the ultimate goal of just making the food and hospitality industry a more diverse, equitable, and inclusive place for people who are usually not centered in the story of how food happens in a place like New York, let alone the world. So every event we kind of run with that in mind.
Yeah, it's I went to the event last year that you did with Chef Kia Damon when she was at Lolito.
Yes.
And it was for Pride, and it was just such a beautiful, like, first of all, the music was amazing.
Second, yes, oh my God, yes.
Yeah, I had like one too many nutcrackers.
Same.
But and like lots of delicious food. Can you talk about kind of how important, you mentioned it a little bit, but like how important the atmosphere and like the style of dining is to like getting your message across with Yardy?
Absolutely. Yeah. So I think for events, something that has been really important to us, and this also stems from the fact that, you know, I went to art school. So art, design, and performance studies have always been at the forefront of my mind when I'm thinking of how to relate to people and in ways that are, I guess you would classify as like non-traditional. But the cool thing about being an artist and a chef is that we're so attuned to what's going on. There's like a spatial awareness. There's like a visual awareness that helps you to get something that is just raw produce into something that is servable, delicate, exciting, confidently executed onto a plate. And then how that energy, I think, translates into the dining room is really important because, you know, for me, hospitality always starts with home and this idea of generosity. So really what you're doing is you're giving a part of yourself, a part of an experience to someone. And that doesn't just start and stop with what's on the plate, but also translates really beautifully into the way that music happens, you know, the way that music and language happens. It's very much so attached to this idea of like how you want people to feel when they're sitting in a space, or what you can also kind of like guide them into thinking about. So whenever we do events, we have, you know, a meeting as a group to talk about like what are the ways that we can kind of tune in or hone in on something that maybe we hadn't thought about before, via, be it, you know, how, like, maybe there are no utensils, like culturally, what are people doing about eating if there are, like, if silverware wasn't a thing, you know, like not every culture uses silverware in the same way that we think about, you know, happens in fine dining. And also like having a sit down dinner is just one format that you can approach. You can also think about, like, I think about like block parties growing up. I think about coming to New York in the summer when it was a baby shower or someone's birthday or a wedding or an anniversary or something, and just like having the whole neighborhood gather and just like being outside. And it was just a very active experience that also had food as a part of it that really set the tone for understanding the values of the people who were coming together to participate in that thing. So, you know, an environment is everything. It's on the same sort of level as thinking about what the food is going to be like for someone.
So I want to hear more about your path to Yardi. You know, did the idea start to happen in art school, or did it come along after that?
So I guess Yardi in my mind always, for me, started with my father's restaurant. It was one of the most formative, I think, experiences that I had, because one, it was a family owned business. It was a Black owned business. It was a business owned by immigrants. It started as a small kind of like counter service place. And then he developed it into something that felt more akin to like a dinner space or a lounge space, like knocked down the wall, expanded to the commercial space that was next to it, and built it out into this really beautiful dream that he had. And that stuck with me throughout my experience in art school. So I think it kind of went hand in hand, and I didn't really have language for it or words for it when it was happening, but, you know, I was always making something, whether it be food or whether it be design or a drawing or painting or whatever. So they kind of coalesced because I kind of used both as a way to express whatever sort of experience that was happening in that moment, whether it be, you know, having people over for food or thinking about just bonding with people over drinks after class. Like, I think that all of those things kind of really did inform the ways in which I think about Yardi now and why it's so important. But it definitely started with my dad's restaurant.
In a way, do you know Omar Tate, who runs Honeysuckle?
Oh my God, yes, absolutely.
Yes. Love his work. he uses this term, you know, Honeysuckle is my fake ass restaurant. And yeah. I was thinking absolutely. Of that with you, with Yardi. It's like, it's your fake ass restaurant that's completely rooted in a real restaurant space that existed for you and that opened up, you know, it showed you, you said the meaning of hospitality is home. And I mean, that seems so poignant in terms of your story. It literally was home as well.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it was, it's funny because I feel like, you know, a lot of my memories came from being in that space, not just like, you know, my dad, but like my older brother and my sister, who is the eldest of us three, were all sort of in that space. And we grew up there. We literally did grow up there, and we did learn so much about each other from that experience. And, you know, it was beautiful, colored with, you know, all the memories that my father and my mother, you know, had and brought to the table when it came to shaping what that restaurant would look like. But it was also really difficult too. It was also a time in which I was learning things about, you know, what it meant to have a business and what it meant to think through finances in a very specific way. And that moment that really shaped the ways I think about not only being an artist or a chef, but also as a business owner in this moment. And I hope that, you know, I think the one thing that I say about Yardi is like, obviously, yes, we like our mission is about diversity, equity, and inclusion and just centering other narratives in that space. But also for me, it's like, I really want to be able to look back on this moment and know that I didn't necessarily get everything right, but knowing that's okay because I can share that with someone who maybe wants to have a similar business or, you know, wants to go into like be a chef or wants to start something on their own, and how much support it actually takes to do something well and to do something that is actually community driven or artistically driven. And so it's been really, really challenging, but such a generative challenge to be put in a position where you actually have ownership over something or want to have ownership over something as well.
Ownership is, has been, for me personally, just in the last like 6 months, something that I've been really thinking about as well. And I'm not as far along as, you are in terms of that, but like, I think ownership, like you said, like there is this like responsibility that comes with it of, okay, well, if I own something, if I own this space, if I'm putting my name on it, if I'm putting my story out there and owning it, what does that look like? What does it feel like? And I can't think of like a more intimate setting with in which to like explore that than a dinner party.
Absolutely.
You said something about being both chef and artist. Do you feel like you're both of those terms 50-50, or is it 70-30, or how do you see it?
That's a really good question. And to be honest, it's something that I think changes as often as the day does for me. And that's mostly because really one of the biggest challenges I think that I faced when I first started the company was not thinking that either of those things fit together really well, and also not having the confidence to really claim any with the amount of confidence and openness that I really needed to step into that role, to be like, no, this is an idea that I'm putting out and I want to put these things forward because I care about it. And a lot of that, as I've, you know, I've spoken with a lot of chef friends before, when they have, you know, press or visibility around what they're doing, is you know, suffer from this imposter syndrome where it's like, okay, well, I like this thing. This thing is my passion. I'm doing this because I've been doing it because I wanted to do it for myself. And how that changes based on media or social media or, you know, the desire to please people or to put your best foot forward and to not make a mistake makes it hard sometimes to really mitigate the desire that you have and the sort of the optics around what you're doing. And I think that for me, I've had to lean into the fact that like on whatever day I need to be one thing, that's what it should be, versus me feeling like, okay, well, in order to fulfill this thing, let me more clearly define what it means to be an artist. Because, you know, I think we have all these very delicate and beautiful multiplicities within us as people where it's like, yeah, I cook, but also, you know, this is the way I'm thinking about this. And it is about art for me, you know, whether it be the way that I craft a menu or think about lighting for an event or the way that we, you know, commission performers to perform at some of our events or dancers or what have you. Like, I think it folds into the larger story and the larger vision. And I also will say that, you know, as a Jamaican person, I think historically, classically, just playing so many different roles, like having to wear so many different hats and like being good at so many different things and having multiple jobs at once is just fully like.
I was wondering if you were going to mention that.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it's full, like that's fully the vibe. It's like, okay, well, today I guess I'm going to be a repair person because the walk-in is broken or the refrigerator is not running at the right temp. And I don't really have the time or money to call someone to fix it. So I guess it's me today. You know, or the negotiation hat where you're going into a meeting and, you know, making a claim for what your value is and what you're bringing to a client, you know, or, you know, the role of mentor when you're talking to new staff. So I think it really just depends on the day for me and what I'm being called to do. And I think that for me, it's being okay with the fact that it's not always going to be the same and that there's no formula around that.
And I mean, that's it. That must be, or feel so freeing, or does it feel, I don't know, like sometimes expansiveness feels like very freeing and then other times it's like, shit, which way do I go? You know, if there's so many options, like which one does it feel like for you?
I think that's a really good question, you know, and I think that over the past 50 plus days, I've had a lot of time to think about what that means for me. So I think that in so far as I know that I have a bigger vision and a bigger dream that does involve a lot of work, that I've had to have more graciousness with myself and a bit more compassion for myself to understand that, you know, as a Black queer person, and I am oftentimes operating in a system that doesn't always support the visions and dreams that I hope to see happen in the world as quickly as I need it to happen. And I think that a lot of people maybe don't have that same story, but I think can relate in a parallel way. Just thinking about like, if you're a woman who owns a business, or if you're a trans person, or if you have some sort of disability, like the ways in which things happen around you just look different because, you know, there is the majority says that this is what it is. And I think that I lean into my expansiveness when I don't know, like I guess when I have time to just like take a breath and think for myself of what I want to see and what I care about, I know that all those things are possible. But I think I've also had to mature in a way to realize that like, it's okay to be more patient and that, you know, we're running on time that is dictated by like money and success in a very specific way that doesn't always give space for mental health and emotional health. And to be able to like actually make time and space for those things and to also hone those things too, right? Like I think one thing that happened for me that I had to realize is that, you know, when you say you're going to do something and someone wants it, the expectation is that it's going to be, you know, or maybe I should say the expectation is that you are putting your best, you know, self, your best work forward all the time. And that's just actually not what happens. Like, you know, like sometimes like it's a process and there has to be a built-in time for like learning and patience towards what you don't know and getting better at those things and a willingness to get better at those things. So I feel like for me, it's okay to be expansive, but I think it's also really important to walk alongside that idea with this idea of patience and a bit more compassion and grace for where you are and not just where you want to go.
I think that's what you said there was so important. You know, realizing that, you know, every day is not going to be a 5-star day. Like sometimes it's a 1-star, sometimes it's a no star.
Absolutely.
And you said something else really important that I wrote down is I lean into my expansiveness. And if you're going to be expansive, then I think as people, we need to realize that that includes like successes and failures.
Yep.
And I think sometimes we highlight the successes so much and because of like the mediums that we have to engage with one another, especially right now, we kind of skip over that like murky, rough bit of like when you fail at something and even the time afterwards where you have to like pick yourself back up from the failure. It's kind of all about success right now, which is tough.
Right. Exactly.
Really tough. I'm curious if you have like a set menu that you tend to stick to with Yardi, or do you kind of, you know, go by what you want to eat in the moment or what you want to serve in the moment?
Yeah. So, I mean, that's a good question, because we've actually been playing around with different models, because I think, you know, the question on everyone's mind right now is like, you know, what is the future of food and what is the future of hospitality? I mean, that's always been the question. Let's be clear that the hospitality was already in a very precarious place prior to the current moment. But I think that what it's really done is given me a time to watch, listen, and highlight the sort of responses from all types of businesses and very talented people who have, you know, created institutions, restaurants, dining spaces prior to our, not only prior to, but also in a different way than what we have to offer as a company. So, one thing that is really important to me, and actually is another kind of like creation point when it comes to Yardi, is, you know, I was doing a ton of research on, you know, Black and Brown farm communities when I started the company, and even before that, when I was just private chefing on my own, because I always wanted to make sure that I could keep track of how other producers who shared in a similar position or identity as I did were create what they were creating, and also like what they were putting out into the world, and also if the supply chain made space for them. And I think that that's, you know, something that's always been really important to my work, is to figure out, you know, like, yes, I want to create very beautiful food that people keep coming back to, and I also want to be mindful of like what my costs are, but how can we slowly create moments in which we are supporting the people that we love and the work that we love to see, and work is that is also reflective of our experiences, and getting people to buy into that, right? Like, I think that one thing that I always say when I'm, you know, talking to people about, you know, why this vegetable over this one, you know, why Caribbean spices versus the more conventional thing that you might find at Whole Foods or when you're ordering online from your suppliers, is, you know, every time we put a plate or a meal or a menu down in front of one of our guests, that's one moment to have someone build their own connection beyond you in that moment of what an ingredient might be. And obviously all ingredients are tied back to this really incredible system of farmers and growers that allow us to eat in the first place. And I think that what the pandemic has revealed about the supply chain to people who maybe hadn't been aware of what was happening before is really important. It's like a really integral moment to really reconsider the ways in which we have access and the way that we're able to get the things that we kind of just go to the store and happen upon as a convenient part of our day. And I want to make sure that our business is able to keep that in mind as we grow and as we expand, because, you know, sometimes we do like small intimate dinners that are 12 people, but sometimes we also do events that are galas that are 300 to 400 people, right? And that's 400 opportunities for me to get Scotch Bonnet or Mangosteen or whatever produce that we have in front of someone who maybe didn't have a connection point to that before, which also puts dollars and resources back into the hands of people who really, really need that support and on a larger scale. So I guess that's a roundabout way of answering your question, which is, you know, I think that our menus change based on what our suppliers are excited about. And I think that that's a model that I've been really excited to explore more.
That is really amazing. And I think, yeah, to your point, I think people are really realizing like, oh, you know, when I order something on Fresh Direct or, you know, any sort of grocery delivery service, it takes a lot for it to get to you.
Right.
You know, it doesn't just like poof, you type
right.
it in
and right,
it
right, right.
materializes out of thin air. Like it takes a lot of work and a huge supply chain to get it to you.
Exactly.
Do you have any like favorite dishes that you served at Yardi that you feel like really speak to the mission and like the ethos of your pop-ups?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's funny because I was actually on the phone with my mom the other day. I've been doing these recordings of my family just to get an idea of like what their experience with like immigration from Jamaica to New York looked like, especially in the 60s and 70s. And a lot of times, like, you know, the questions will then happen to have like a food or dinner moment. Like both my parents lived in Jamaica. My dad lives on a farm. His grandparents are farmers. And I always just like love hearing little anecdotes that they are telling me about, like, you know, we had to go and catch the chicken ourselves if we wanted to have that for dinner the next day. It's just like, you know, things that like seeing them now being fully like brought into like American culture in this very specific way, and then realizing that like there's so many things that we like haven't discussed, and so many things that like inform the ways in which we eat now. So I was talking to my mom about pepper shrimp, which is like one of my favorite things to make, because when you go to Jamaica and you're like just driving down the road and you're at a stoplight, someone may come up to you in your car and have like Otaheite apple or pepper shrimp in a bag that they maybe made that day and are just selling. It's like this little kind of like very like pedestrian like snack food that, you know, seems like nothing because it's in a plastic bag, but it's also like packed with so much flavor. And so I like serving that at our events because it's something that encourages people to like eat with their hands first and foremost. But then also it's a little anecdote or a little viewfinder, like a window into this world, which is how other people are thinking about food and how people are relating to food in the place that I really care about. So that one's a really big one. And then the other one that I think about is I have this coconut todo cake that I make oftentimes, which is reflective of, you know, every like Christmas or every like holiday, my Bayesian godmother would give us this really incredible todo cake, which is like a quick bread that's wrapped in foil. And it meant so much to me to receive that. Because it was like a sign that she was thinking about us, and I've adapted it into a dessert item that we have on our menu that I really like to share with people because it reminds me of that connection to family. You know, going back to the idea of the home, and also prioritizing, you know, what you might consider domestic or home food over what is, you know, the more like delicate or more intricate institutional food of like something that's high end, where I think that both of those things can actually live together, both the domestic kind of casual thing and also the high end thing. Like I think that there's space for both, and I like when our menus kind of do that.
Can you describe the cake that you give to guests, like your version of it?
Yeah, for sure. So the original recipe is a quick bread, which essentially you know, it means it's a bit more like it's more dense. But the one that we do, we fold in like a lot of brown butter, and we use coconut cream. We use coconut flakes, and we usually dress it with candied hibiscus and labneh, just because I really like labneh a lot. It's not a Caribbean thing, but it's really delicious. Yeah, it's just like a really like fun cake to serve. And I'm like a huge dessert person, so I'm always thinking about like how to end dinner or like start a party with dessert.
Oh, that sounds so good. Yeah, I'm like between the shrimp and the cake, I'm like, oh, I would love that right now.
I know. I'll definitely send you some if I can.
Oh my goodness, that would be great. So speaking of your parents, speaking of wearing many hats and speaking of your parents, one of the things that I think is really interesting is how you tie in like not just visual elements into your events, but also into your social media presence. And like you tie in these like photos of your parents and you in these like gorgeous, elaborate sets with food. And it's such a like, it's visually stunning first. And then there's so much to tease out. I'm like, I'm not doing a good job of describing these photos, but
No. I think you definitely are. No, for sure.
If you don't follow Devon online, you should. But at the yardie.nyc account on Instagram, there's gorgeous, gorgeous photos of your parents and you and different foods. And I'm curious how that came about.
Yeah, so it's actually funny because as you're talking to me, I'm staring at this photo of my mom on my wall, which I love.
Aww.
These photos mean so much to me, you know, like I was working on a separate project in the UK one summer. I think it was summer of 2015 or maybe 2016. And I came back home feeling really energized about that project, but also realized that I was operating in a space that didn't really include the like Black and Brown narrative. Like it didn't include the queer narrative or the Jamaican narrative in the ways that I wanted it to, which is totally that's totally fine. Like, you know, I was hired to do a thing and then I had to, basically what I'm saying is I had to come home and decide in a lot of ways what was my own take on a food project. Like, what was my food identity? And if I wasn't seeing that as readily as I needed to in the spaces that I was occupying in the markets or in the restaurants or in groceries, what did I want to do about it? And could I do anything about it? And so I was home one summer and I was going through family photos and found all these really gorgeous photos of my mom in the 70s. And one particular photo, she was wearing the suit that my grandmother had sewn for her. It's beautiful. She kind of looked like a flight attendant. Like it was just like this beautiful, like this very like structured suit, was pantsuit and this beautiful, like, gorgeous like scarf around her neck, and her hair was perfect and the makeup was stunning and she had this huge backdrop behind her. And she was this young woman who had, you know, come to New York and was just kind of living her best life. And I was like, wow, this energy in this photo, how many years later still translates as this timeless thing. And how can I recreate that? How can we continue that legacy, you know, that was being set forward by all the things that were happening? Like and speaking of entrepreneurship, right? Like my grandmother came over to New York because she was a seamstress in Jamaica. She was very successful and then started sewing wedding dresses and custom dresses for women in Brooklyn. Which is how she was able to pay for a part of the way they were able to pay for her family to come over. And so I always wanted to, you know, my mom and I are extremely close. She's one of the reasons why I cook to this day, just her energy and spirit around food, and also just being a loving mother, and also, you know, very stern, but also like very, very gracious and generous at the same time. And just wanting to celebrate and honor those photos, but also in a contemporary setting. So for me, the idea of making photos and thinking about the subjects within photos is really important because, you know, we're contending every day with our culture and our history being erased. And something that we can do and should be doing for ourselves is creating documentation and an archive for ourselves, for the present, but also for the future, to be like, okay, well, these are the things that we cared about. How can we, you know, how can we own and tell that story? So with Yardie as a brand, those photos, my mother and just her as a person have always been kind of like our ambassador in a lot of ways, because it's everything that photo did for me was contest this idea that, you know, Jamaican culture or Black culture is not a value, that it doesn't have the same type of value, that it can't compete successfully in different markets. And that is totally not true. And I feel like every time I think about those photos, it reminds me at my lowest of lows, of my like darkest of days, that like actually it's totally possible to create and be the mastermind behind your own narrative. And that other people also want to celebrate and support you in creating that. And that's what those photos do for me.
Yeah, it's, and there's something so powerful about self-documentation. Like, I think with me, like as a writer, it's, I definitely try to document the present moment, but I think there is something that I can never replicate, which is someone documenting themselves and their work. You know, and just thinking about your mom in these, like in this photo, you know, taking it because she wanted to, you know, like just the power and the like agency that that like conveyed even to you like decades later is very powerful.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. So you also, you know, beyond these photos, you are also a model.
Yeah.
Yep. You're so casual. Yep.
It's funny. Let me just tell you that before I said yep, there were so many other responses that were running through my head. Then I had to think about, and then I had to think about what we just talked about in terms of leaning in. So I am fully leaning into that as a title as well.
Yes, multiplicities. You are chef, yes, artist, model, photographer, all these things.
Yes, yes,
yes.
Shall we unpack that?
Yes, let's unpack.
Okay.
But how did you get into modeling?
Yeah, so I mean, it's kind of funny. I was dating a fashion photographer, which is like this tale as old as time, and who is now my best friend. His work is incredible. He actually just released a book. His name is Charlie Engman. Go check it out if you haven't seen it. And his friend, who is a designer, was just like, "Oh, your boyfriend's really cute. Will you be in one of my shows?" And I was like, "Yeah, of course. I would love to do that. That sounds really fab." And I'd never done the show before. You know, I was just like, "Okay, well, I obviously like love fashion. My relationship to fashion is like a little like teen gay boy in his room watching America's Next Top Model, like." Every night it was on, just like waiting for that moment. That was my connection to fashion. And I guess also like, you know, my parents were fashionable. I do think about clothing, but it wasn't until that moment where I thought of that as a viable avenue to like express myself or to like, you know, going back to the idea of making imagery, like how to also put myself in those images. And I was actually really, really hesitant at first because, you know, I think fashion kind of like, and food too can be huge vanity projects, right? Where you're like, okay, well, this is just kind of, I don't know if I can say this on radio, but like, you know, a circle jerk or like very like masturbatory, like self-fulfilling.
Oh yeah, that's totally fine to say.
Okay, good. I'm like, what can I, yeah, but you know, just like kind of like self-serving images or, you know, recreating yourself over and over again in attempt to like fulfill or satisfy some desire to be seen or known. And I kind of had to check myself in that moment when I had gotten more offers to do work like that, because I realized that kind of like that image of my mother, right? Like if I was a young, like gay Caribbean, queer Caribbean person, a black male, or, you know, looking at that photo, what would that do or who would that serve? And like, is there a way to make sure that those images and those ideas serve someone outside of myself? And if so, why not pursue that? And I think that this is something that, like I said, I've had to kind of convince myself of, because it's difficult. I mean, also to be completely candid too, like when I was growing up, like people were like, why, like people were just like, you know, why is your skin so dark? Or like, why are your parents talk like that when they're mad at you? Like, why are they, what is patois?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so I think that for me, I had to kind of remember, like, if I had that as a template to validate my experience or to verify my experience and also combat that loneliness that happens when you feel like you're the only one or that you're some like abnormality or this exception to this standard, then why not pursue that? And I think that modeling has definitely opened up that door to think about, you know, visual culture is everything. It's everywhere we see, it's everywhere we go. It's up to people who are bold enough and radical enough to know that they can like use their image to change the way that someone is thinking about demographics outside of themselves or demographics that they don't get to experience on a daily basis. So in that way, it's become really, really important for me as a platform.
Yeah, it's it ties so well into Yardi too. It's like all kind of you. It's clear that you think very deeply about how people engage with and experience, you know, both the actual like photographs, but also like eating food and being in a space and listening to music, and you know, it's all clear that like as an artist and a chef, you think about like these things in total package.
Yeah, for sure. And I think too, I mean, like, I hope you don't hate me for saying this, but like that article that you wrote about the grill, I think about all the time, because you know, what you're also doing there is you're talking about like the condition of like where we are in that moment too, where it's like, mm-hmm. why don't I feel good about this? Like, why don't I feel good that I'm being able to have this experience? And for me, it's always been like, how can I signal that it's okay to bring more people, not more than okay, you know, it's a radical change that we need to see, that we need to bring more people in who have different experiences and have different perspectives. Mm-hmm. And that is kind of, you know, what I hope that like food or fashion can do for, you know, especially as it relates to Yardi.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you are doing that, which is really amazing to see and to watch. So we are going to take a quick break and we're going to come back and talk more with Devon Francis about, you know, his upbringing and dining in his life. And we'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by the Michigan Cherry Committee. A cherry isn't just a cherry. When it comes to tart cherries, the wonderfully U.S.-grown Montmorency tart cherry variety is the cherry with more. They're available year-round, dried, frozen, canned, juice, and concentrate. U.S. Montmorency tart cherries are also one of America's superfruit, which means they're good for you. Tart cherries contain many antioxidants and beneficial phytonutrients, including anthocyanins, the pigments that give tart cherries their bright red color. And don't forget about flavor. U.S. Montmorency's unique sour-sweet profile make them an excellent addition to yogurt, oatmeal, salads, trail mix, and of course, a classic cherry pie. Learn more about the wonderfully U.S.-grown Montmorency tart cherry at choosecherries.com.
All right, so we are back with Devon Francis of Yardi. So now we're going to get a bit more personal, which I feel like we've been personal this whole time. do you have any early memories of dining when you were growing up? Were there any like traditions that you and your family had?
Well, it's actually funny because my mom always makes fun of me for this very one memory, which is, you know, when I was younger, she had this really gorgeous, like clear, this glass table that she had all this really, I always make fun of my mom because I'm always like, you know who you remind me of? You remind me of Dominique Devereaux from Dynasty. Because she has this energy about her where she's just like, she walks into your room and people are just like, who do you think you are? And then you're like, wait a minute, no, this is totally valid. Like, you fully can do whatever you want. So she had this like beautiful, like opulent, decadent crystal dinner plateware set that she would always set the table with. Even if, and maybe this, I don't know if this is like a Black family thing, but like you would have the dinner table that like you didn't always eat at, like the nice one, mm-hmm, with all the things on it. Because yeah, you couldn't touch. But I always love to go and like move things around on that table and just like stare at the table. And she would come into that room and find me staring at the table. And she's like, Devon, what are you doing staring at this table? And so for me, and I think that like thinking back, I'm like, wait a minute, that memory makes so much sense now in my life where, you know, it totally is about what you're eating, but it's also like what you're eating on and how you're eating and who you're eating with and what you feel like when you're eating that thing. So that's like one of the biggest sort of food memories that I can think about, that I think about.
Yeah, that does totally make sense in like, in the grand scheme of, like, you know, what your work is now, like, of course you'd be staring at, like, the actual, like, pieces of, you know, flatware and the crystal. And it sounds like dynasty-esque. It's amazing.
God. My God. I should have a dynasty themed dinner, honestly.
It's, oh my God, please.
Needs to happen.
Oh, a like Caribbean dynasty mashup. Oh. Oh my God.
That would be
amazing.
You have to be the one of the hosts though.
I will. I will get decked out. I wore my fanciest. I will wear pearls.
Yes.
I'm there. As long as there's nutcrackers too, I'll be there.
Oh my God, absolutely.
So I'm curious what you're taking in right now, like in terms of, you know, art and music, and what's like inspiring you at the moment?
Yeah. I mean, honestly, so many things. I think the one of the first things that I did when everyone went into quarantine / isolation is order a ton of books. And so I recently finished the Monica White book which is called Freedom Farmers.
Yes, amazing book.
Oh, my stars. When I tell you, it was like, I had to like stop and like breathe at moments because I was like, wait a minute. I mean, for so many reasons, like one, reading about Tuskegee, reading about just, you know, the idea of mapping or tracing the ways in which like, you know, African-American people are moving based on like forced migration and the change of industry and mechanization, like all those things really got me just thinking about how important it is for me to continue this work, but also like to understand that there is precedent for people trying to make things happen well beyond me doing this, which made me feel actually like very hopeful. Like I was like, there are so many resources that are still left to uncover and so many stories that like we can use to as templates to figure out how to like make this to make things better, and that like, yeah, like systemic oppression has been a thing and there are incredible people who have great language and great resources and great documents to show you like this is like how we're trying to work through those things. And I really appreciated reading that, especially the piece about Fannie Lou Hamer, just really, really blew me away. And then, yeah, I also just ordered Shannon Mustafer's Tiki book.
Yes.
Shannon is so inspirational because she's really good at, she just knows her product and her history and the culture so well. And the fact that it just comes out when she speaks so naturally is so inspiring to me. I really admire the fact that like she really, really just studies and tries and experiments, and you know, it shows in the way that she expresses herself, and how much of a resource she's become in her field.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Those are some great choices.
Oh, for sure. I mean, yeah. I mean, I have like, if you want, the mood board is, it's huge. It's long and huge. Oh, and then I would also say my friend, this is the last one, my friend, or actually there's two, my friend Jayla, because music is super important to me. My friend Jayla just released her EP, which is so beautiful. I hope that everyone makes some time to go and listen to it. She has an incredible, incredible voice. It's like, I don't even know where to start. It's called Ache of Victory. Please go listen to it. And then my friend Kimberly Drew, just she's been doing a podcast for Hulu called Your Attention Please, where she's highlighting Black creatives. Those are my top four.
Awesome. And what was the name of your friend's EP?
It's called Ache of Victory.
Ache of Victory. Wow, that's a great title.
Oh, it's please listen to it and text me as soon as you do and tell me if you cried or not. Thank you.
I will. So I have a question that I ask every guest on this podcast, and it's the last question. If you could have your last meal in a restaurant, where would it be and who's invited?
Oh my God. Can it be anywhere in the world?
Anywhere in the world, and you can invite people, living, dead, celebrities, normal folk.
Oh, crazy. Yeah. Oh my God. Okay. I would have it at Summer House in Jamaica. Because the last time I was there, they were building, the Russo sisters, they were building out the space and I didn't get a chance to eat the food, but I love them so much. They've become amazing friends of mine. I hope we keep growing in our friendship. And I would invite, wow, this is a hard one. So definitely Viola Davis.
Okay.
Very important. It could honestly just be me and Viola. I fully would just be like, I answered the question. I don't feel any type of way. Viola Davis, I would invite, I'm thinking of anyone. I'm trying to think of someone who's dead who I'm like, I want all your secrets. Like, what did you not tell us? That's hard. Whitney Houston.
Oh, okay.
Whitney Houston.
That's a good one.
Yeah, I have a lot of questions for Whitney.
And I'm so glad you shouted out the Russo sisters because they've been on the podcast.
Yes.
And also they are just experts of like Jamaican culture and history and living icons themselves. And
for sure. We had a really great dinner. This is a side note that I'm sure we don't have time for, but we had a really great dinner at Hearts, and we just like kiki'd like the whole time. I was just gagging. I was like, I'm going to tell you all the stories. I was just like,
that's amazing.
The only reason I bring that up is because I like to say when you find out how human people are and how like just down to earth people are, it's so refreshing. Because there's this energy around like people who would just, they work so hard and done so much, but they're just so humble and funny and warm. And I love them. So anyway, so yeah, I would say those two people. And then who would be the third person that I would invite? Cause I feel like three is a good number. I don't know.
Would you have any family there?
I should probably invite my family. I'd invite my grandmother actually, because I have two grandmothers. I invite both my grandmothers because I really want to be able to have a dinner in Jamaica with them. And actually, in my adult life, I haven't done that, I realize.
Wow.
I'd love to do that.
What are you eating?
Oh, God. There was this really amazing blue marlin, I believe, dish on the menu before that they had that I wanted to try. If I could suggest things to them to make in the kitchen that I'd want to see them make, they have this really delicious, I think it's like a chickpea and like papaya dish that I would love to try. It's a vegetarian dish. And then just like probably like a lot of dessert, actually. I want like all of the desserts. And like a really good cocktail. Good.
Yes. Is there a specific cocktail that you want or a specific rum that you want to be in the cocktail?
Is there a specific I've been drinking a lot of painkillers.
Oh, yes.
I just always do, just because I love coconut. And it's like, it feels like you're having another meal a little bit. And the nutmeg is, I don't know. It's just like such a fun, I have such a sweet tooth if I'm being completely honest about who I am. Like I just love candy and like sweet things.
Painkiller sounds so good right now.
Yeah.
Well, I appreciate you being on the show so much and like sharing your story. When this is all over, we need to cheers with a couple of painkillers.
Oh my God, please. Yes. That would be amazing.
So how can listeners find out more about you, about Yardi? Like where should they look for you online?
Yeah. So two places. The first is I've just been trying to be a resource by making up all these cooking videos like we kind of talked about earlier. So if you want to find me, my personal Instagram is Tuna Turner, T-U-N-N-A, T-U-N-A underscore underscore T-U-R-N-E-R my God, spelling is hard for me today. And then the business one is yardi.nyc. And then we're also actually starting a delivery program so that we can actually share our meals to people at home. So that's the most exciting kind of like new thing that's happening for us.
Oh, that's amazing. And when is that starting?
We're starting it next week, actually. We're doing a little, little soft launch. Yeah.
And it will be in the Brooklyn area?
We're going to start in Brooklyn for now, but I also have a bunch of people who are like, please, this Manhattan. So I'm going to figure it out. But yeah, Brooklyn 2-day delivery to start.
Wow, that's incredible.
I'm so excited. And the coconut cake is being featured in the delivery. Yes.
Awesome. Well, Devon, thank you so much for being on the show. This was great, and we have to, definitely get together and see each other face to face, like as soon as this is all done.
I would love that. And also, just stay well. And if you need anything, let me know, please. I'm around and I just want to be of service to anyone who needs it. So if it's just like info or phone call or whatever, just I'm here.
Absolutely. And same goes to you.
Thank you so much. And thank you for inviting me again. I hope to talk soon.
Of course. Thank you for being on the show.
This program is powered by Simplecast.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.